From KUWR News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Mormon and Jewish leaders say they've agreed to work out their differences on the controversial practice of performing proxy Mormon ordinances for dead Jews, particularly victims of the Holocaust. It's not just Jews, though, who may have an issue over the LDS mission to redeem the dead of the world. While hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of these ordinances go unnoticed every year, church leaders are having to defend some of the more high-profile ones, like the baptism of Joan of Arc, a name apparently submitted by well-meaning members dozens of times, and the recent proxy marriage sealing of Pope Pius XII on October 12th of 2002 in the Nauvoo Temple. Mormon leaders point out that these ordinances are a conditional gift, which only have meaning for those deceased who accept them in the afterlife. But it's raised broader questions about religious freedom and the significance of religious symbolism. We'll talk about it today, after this news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Jewish leaders and leaders from The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints met yesterday in Salt Lake City to discuss what's become the controversial Mormon practice of proxy baptisms for the dead. Leaders say thousands of Jews, many of them victims of the Holocaust, have continued to be posthumously baptized in Mormon temples, despite an agreement signed in 1995 to stop that practice. The agreement was reaffirmed yesterday, and both sides said the conversation was warm and respectful. Today in the program, we're exploring the issues raised by the story with a genealogical database of billions of names. Part of this is about the limits of technology, but there are also some deeply felt symbolic and religious questions at stake as well. Mormon leaders point out that these ordinances are conditional gifts, which only have meaning for those deceased who accept them in the afterlife. But there are some strong feelings attached to the symbolism of life and death here. Going to be talking about it today, and we invite you to join the conversation. 585 West is the number, 585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuwr.org. Joining us from her home in California is Carol Skydell. Skydell is an amateur genealogist who discovered her own grandparents and aunt and uncle had been baptized by proxy. And Carol Skydell, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for asking me.
Let me begin with your story. How is it you discovered that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints had performed a proxy baptism for your ancestors?
Well, it was quite by accident. In probably the summer of 2002, when I was doing some research and found my very unusual surname, Feldhair, listed in the IGI.
And explain what the IGI is.
Pardon me.
Explain what the IGI is.
The International Genealogical Index, which is the church's public database of all the names that have been of interest to them. I later learned that what it meant to be in the IGI was that you were either posthumously baptized or were scheduled to be. And this I learned from other genealogists who were far more knowledgeable about this than I.
So how did you react? I mean, can you explain why this is so deeply troubling for Jews, certainly some Jews?
Well, it was deeply troubling to me. As a matter of fact, I kind of felt like I was punched in the solar plexus when I saw the name of my very religious Jewish grandmother listed as being in the IGI, and at that time I had learned, of course, that what being in the IGI meant. So I was outraged, I was upset, and I turned to others to find out, what do I do about this? And I learned that I could request removal. This was done, the name was removed. But when I began to think about it, the name had been submitted by a distant cousin who is Mormon and was following her church's directives to posthumously baptize her own ancestors. However, I also found out that there was a 1995 agreement which specified that any Mormon doing this was obligated to get the written permission of other members of the family. Nobody asked me. Nobody asked anybody that I knew. So I subsequently began to dig into this and learned about the efforts of Ernie Michel and called him and asked him what I could do to help in his quest. So that's how I became involved.
We should mention that Ernest Michel is the chairman of the New York-based World Gathering of the Jewish Holocaust Survivors. He's going to be a guest on this program as well a little bit later. Let me ask you, Carol Skydell, we're going to be getting to some of the details here as we go, but one of the responses that you hear from Mormon leaders is that this is effectively it's simply an option that they're offering to the departed, and that it's a choice that those in the next life can choose to accept or reject. How do you respond to that? That this isn't a compulsion. It's, in fact, simply an offering that has no effective meaning if you don't actually believe in the notion of or the ordinances of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
I have several responses to that. First of all, the ritual does not say, I offer you the opportunity to accept the tenets of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It simply says, I baptize you. And if it's an offer, where is the list of those who have said no thank you? I mean, the whole thing is, well, it's difficult for me to express without sounding as if I'm criticizing somebody's religion, and I don't mean to do that. But it is somewhat illogical to think that people can be offered something, have no opportunity to reject it at the time of the offer, and perhaps later they will accept it. I can't follow that line of reasoning.
The 1995 agreement that you referred to between the church and some Jewish leaders was reaffirmed yesterday. Ernest Michel has told the press that he felt somewhat satisfied by at least the initial gathering. Are you satisfied with what you've heard of the meeting this weekend? And I think I said yesterday. I meant Sunday, I believe. Or perhaps it was yesterday.
Yesterday.
Yes, and yesterday, the series of meetings, I guess it was. Are you satisfied with what's happened so far?
I'm still not certain what has happened since I've only had an opportunity to read about it in various press reports. From my perspective, I think that it was probably productive in that it provided for a means of finding a solution to the problem. The problem has not been solved.
And what do you mean? The problem is what?
The problem is that the various points of the agreement are being violated. And that is the problem.
And by that you mean that Mormons continue to baptize people who died in the Holocaust?
That is correct. And one of the problems is the church has identified those people as overzealous. I take exception to that because the church conducts its own extraction program whereby vital records are filmed by the Genealogical Society of Utah, which nowhere is identified on their permission or the request to film records. Nowhere are they identified as an arm of the church, and nowhere are the custodians of vital records told that the ultimate purpose of this filming will be to posthumously baptize every single one of the names therein. So while the church does have its own patrons obligated to posthumously baptize all of their ancestors, the church also conducts a massive extraction program whereby they use vital records being birth, marriage, or death records, and uses those to posthumously baptize all the names therein. Sometimes I wonder why they just don't take telephone books and throw them into the baptismal pool. It's just as valid.
So you're saying that this extraction program, that while there is a policy, and we'll get to, again, a response from church leaders, but you're saying that while there's a policy that only names should be – the only proper names submitted are those of family members, that, in fact, that's not the way it works in practice. In theory, it's one thing. In practice, it's another.
Well, of course not. I mean, how can every single one of the names taken from the 1907 marriage records of the city of New York be related to the people who are extracting those names? I mean, all you have to do is look at the records. The records speak for themselves.
So, Carol Skydell, who do you think should be off limits? Who should be off limits to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and these proxy ordinances that are so crucial to the mission of this church?
Well, I think that the extraction program should cease as a source of finding names. I think that while I do respect the right of Mormons to posthumously baptize their own ancestors when they have found them, the agreement provides for written permission of the living members of the family. That has never been done. So I would be more comfortable, although I may not like it, I would be more comfortable if the church required written permission. One of the church's own representatives, and his name escapes me at the moment, when questioned about the written permission, said, oh, we've never done that.
Carol Skydell is with us talking from her home in California, and we invite you to join the conversation. By the way, 585-WEST is the number, 585-9378. We'll be taking your calls in about 10 minutes here. David Rencher is joining us now. David Rencher is the director of the Records and Information Division with the Family and Church History Department of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Mr. Rencher was a participant in the meeting with the World Gathering of the Jewish Holocaust Survivors yesterday and Sunday. And David Rencher, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Let me get you first of all, help us to understand why this practice is so important to see to how you see your mission as a church, this idea of proxy ordinances.
Thank you. There is a very specific difference between the responsibility of the church and the responsibility of individuals, and I think that perhaps at times leads to some of the confusion. As individuals, we have a responsibility to search out our kindred dead and our ancestors and to see that these ordinances of salvation are offered to them. This is done through various things that are done in the temples of the church, and that is an offering, as you have suggested previously. As a church, we also feel a responsibility that these ordinances should be offered to all mankind, that anyone who has ever lived. And so over the years, the practice of using the church extraction program to provide additional names when church members do not have their own names to take to the temple are done. I think an important point here, which isn't always understood in the community, is that temple worship is a part of our religion as well, and that if, for example, I was not able to find lines, names on my line, that I would not be able to go to the temple and worship in the temple without a name. So a name is required to attend the temple and to partake in that worship service.
So that's an important point, that that temple ceremonies, the idea of temple, is this is more than just personal worship. This is about this important notion of redeeming the dead.
Yes, it's about both. Temple worship benefits not only those who are living and attend, but we believe has the ability to benefit those who are deceased.
So in the scheme of things, before we don't have to get too particular, but before essentially the end of the world can come, I guess, everyone effectively who's ever been born has to have had this work done on earth, if I understand it correctly.
We believe that it has to be a physical ordinance that has to have been performed, and we believe that everyone at some point in time will have been given the opportunity to accept or reject that offer. As far as as an ordinance is concerned, it is something that we feel is paramount to having eternal salvation.
So I'm wondering if in some ways the church is bound by this divine mandate to do this work, that in some ways your hands are bound. In order for you to fulfill this mission, you have to at some point baptize people who are Hindu or Buddhist or Catholic, for that matter, certainly as well as Jews, and Jews who died in the Holocaust. I mean, that seems to me one of those impasses. I'm not sure how you're going to be able to get around.
Certainly it's a challenge. We believe that in the restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and we believe that in that restoration that all of the things that were in the original church were restored. As part of that, we do believe, therefore, that we are governed by that direct revelation, not by the rules of men. We didn't conceive this thing on our own. We didn't come up with this as men and implement this. We believe literally that it was direct revelation from Jesus Christ, and that we have been told to do this, and that we are thereby executing what we believe that we are told. At the same time, we don't have the liberty to simply cease it, because the Lord has not told us to cease doing it. So within the confines of those bounds, yes, in a sense, we are bound.
So in terms of the meeting that you have with Jewish leaders, what is it that you can say to them? Do you say that for now anyway, we will concede certain souls? Certainly the 400-odd thousand who died in Jewish concentration camps during World War II. I mean, do you have to concede certain people, certain names, at least for a time?
We certainly, as we met with the leaders, expressed our apology for any pain or anything that we had had come about as a result of these names being baptized. Certainly that was directed to them yesterday. And we are sorry for any pain or misunderstanding that the practice concerns. We have agreed that we would make accommodation out of respect for the Jewish community and out of respect for those who did suffer in the Holocaust. We said that there were accommodations which we would make. Those do have a limit. We will only go so far, but we have tried as best we could as honorable men to stand behind that agreement and to do everything in our power to abide by the agreement as it was laid out.
But how does that square with what you say in your from a doctrinal perspective, we can't change the way we worship? I mean, there is a point at which those souls, I suppose, is one way to put it, will have to be dealt with, correct?
Well, there will come a period of time, certainly, in which they will have the opportunity to make known whether or not they want those ordinances performed. And I think that will all be taken care of before the ultimate end.
How do you understand the 1995 agreement, Mr. Rencher? In 1995, you agreed to remove from display. I think this seems an important sort of turn of word. Remove from display the some 380,000 names of Holocaust victims who had been baptized posthumously. What does that mean, removed from display? That doesn't mean then that the rites that had been administered were rescinded or those ordinances reversed or nullified, does it?
There is no ordinance in the church which would reverse a baptism. There was no such ordinance in the original Church of Jesus Christ as it was established on the earth. We don't have a way to undo that baptism. What it does mean is that we will not show that record to the public. They will not, so that out of respect to those who have asked to have those names removed, we have removed those names. And we do, by our official doctrine, do have a mandate that everything that takes place in a temple has an official record, and that we cannot undo. We record every event that took place in every temple every day as far as these ordinances are performed, and that is an official record that takes place in the temple.
So from the perspective, from the perspective of Carol Skydell and others who may be outraged by the fact that their grandmothers or their, you know, great uncles, whomever, who had died in Nazi concentration camps, that damage has been done. There's no undoing that from your perspective. People can't see the name anymore, but the fact is that ordinance already took place and there's no really undoing it.
Which is what we agreed to in 95. The most we could do is to remove it from public view so that their memory was not associated with that ordinance.
So in 95 there was an acknowledgement that there were some sort of doctrinal limitations there as well.
I don't know what was understood in 95. I wasn't part of those arrangements, and I can't tell you clearly what both leaders understood in 95. I can simply tell you what we've tried to implement and how we've tried to honor the agreement since then.
Let me ask, explain, if you would, Mr. Rencher, how the process works, or how it's evolved, if in fact it has evolved. As it stands right now, do you in fact have to be a family member in order to submit a name to this process to receive these proxy ordinances? And was there a time when that had changed? Because clearly you hear about the high-profile baptisms of people like Joan of Arc and certain popes and even ceilings between Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun, and which may represent well-meaning members trying to do what they see as their duty. But it doesn't look very good from sort of, I guess, an outward perspective. How does the system work?
We restate and we continue to restate that members of the church have a responsibility to search out and identify their kindred dead, and that those are the people for whom they have responsibility to see that this information is taken care of. There have been some people who at times, I believe, misunderstood what their intents were, what their purposes were, how they felt about it. I can't speak for that, but they have gone to lists of famous individuals or other names and have chosen to submit those names. So this issue is broader than just the Jewish community. Whenever we identify anyone in the community or within the church submitting lists of names that to which they're not directly related, virtually extraction projects on their own, we notify them, we ask them to cease such practice and ask them to return to their own lines and to do that work. Because we do run the extraction program as a church, we ask them that if they really do want to participate in an extraction program, that they do it within the confines of the policy set up by the church and that they operate within the bounds and the limits that the extraction program is established.
Explain something to me that I found in the press material that has been sent related to this. It states this: We also believe it's not the role of the church to, and I think this gets at what you were sort of saying, you've been saying, we believe it's not the role of the church to enforce practices and compliance upon its members. Rather, it is our role to teach the principles by which members individually worship. Now, some could read that as saying, why couldn't you just have a mandate and in fact enforce it? I mean, you have I expect your members, you know, a deeply obedient membership base. Clearly, won't if you just simply issued a mandate, wouldn't they simply do it? I mean, explain that to me, because I'm confused as to what that means.
Well, I think one of the important points here is that we have 12 million members of the church. We have hundreds of thousands of members who join the church each year. Their understanding of the practice, as it is initially explained to them, that understanding grows over time. So while I think we have members of the church that thoroughly understand the limits and the confines within the policy of what they're to submit, I think we are always dealing with a church populace that are learning how to go about this practice and how to qualify names for submission. Not trying to make excuses there, but it is a growing it is always an ongoing thing.
But there are those who suggest that this is, I'm clearly the more cynical perspective would be that this is just a way for church leaders to look the other way.
Well, I think that every religion would have trouble enforcing certain practices within their religion. In the Jewish community, trying to enforce amongst their members dietary practices or Sabbath practices, to enforce that happens all the time, I think they would agree and have agreed that that is equally unenforceable. We do put policy statements on our sites as members submit names. We do reaffirm the policy. As far as written permission, the written permission has a limit. I don't know the instances around Carol's ancestors, but The written permission extends to people that were born within the last 110 years or who were married within the last 95 years. And at the time, that required permission from a written descendant. Whether or not the person who performed that work actually followed the practice and followed the policy, I don't know. That's one I would have to look into.
David Rencher is with us. He's the Director of Records and Information for the Family History Library of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We want to get Carol Skydell and Ernest Michel involved into the conversation, and you too, but we need to take a break. We're talking about the controversial practice of Mormon proxy baptisms and ordinances, and we invite you to join us at 585 West, 585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We're going to take a break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on FM 90. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Mormon and Jewish leaders say they've agreed to work out their differences on some of the controversial practice of performing proxy Mormon ordinances for dead Jews, particularly victims of the Holocaust. The story has raised broader questions about religious freedom and the significance of religious symbolism. Today in the program, we're talking about it. We invite you to join the conversation. 585 West is the number, 585-9378. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. David Rencher, the Director of Records and Information for the Family History Library of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, is with us. Carol Skydell is also with us by phone from her home in California. She's an amateur genealogist. Joining us now is Ernest Michel. He is a Jewish Holocaust survivor who was taken at the age of 15 to Auschwitz. Michel is the author of the memoir Promises to Keep, One Man's Journey Against Incredible Odds. He served as the executive vice president of the United Jewish Appeal Federation of New York from 1970 to 1989. He's now chairman of the New York-based World Gathering of Jewish Holocaust Survivors. And Ernest Michel joins us today from his office in New York. Ernest Michel, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Let me get you, if I could, to react to what you're hearing so far from Mr. Rencher as to the kind of agreement that was struck in 95, or the reaffirmation of that anyway, that was struck over the weekend.
Well, let me say first of all that I'm cautiously optimistic about the results of our discussion that we had with the church leadership yesterday. I flew back home last night and you reached me in my office in New York. My background is similar, at least as far as the posthumous baptism is concerned, of Carol Skydell, because I learned about maybe 10, 11 years ago through an article in a Jewish newspaper that my father, my mother, my grandmother, uncles, aunts were posthumously baptized. Now, I just couldn't understand it. Why would a church do that? Not even letting me know and baptizing the closest members of my family who were killed because they were Jews. When I found out about it, and it didn't take me long to find out, I contacted Senator Orrin Hatch, and I had written a letter to the then president of the church, President Hunter. I didn't receive a reply immediately from President Hunter, but I received a phone call from Orrin Hatch, who invited me eventually to come to Washington to discuss it. Out of this meeting developed a whole contact between myself and the church, which I had never believed would happen nor anticipated. And as a result of that, in May 1995, it's over a little, almost 10 years ago.
Yeah.
An agreement was signed by official representative of the church and myself under the auspices of the umbrella organization of the American Jewish Community. And the agreement spelled out very directly, quote, to discontinue, let me underline that, to discontinue any future baptism of Jews, period. I mean, that goes further, and they say identified as Jews. There's some more language there, but basically this is what amounts to. Over the years, I and others, including Carol Skydell, whom I respect greatly for her knowledge of genealogy, which I do not have, incidentally, that this agreement was violated. Then followed months and months of telephone calls, letters, memoranda between ourselves and the church. This resulted in an invitation by the church for us to come to Salt Lake City to discuss it. Now, we very much welcomed that opportunity. And therefore, yesterday and on Saturday night, we were guests of the church who treated us royally. And we had a very important discussion on Monday morning that lasted probably, I would say, almost 6 hours with representative leaders of the church, including Mr. Rancher, including the head of the Family History Department, two members of the presidency of the 70. In other words, the church was very visually represented during our meetings.
And how do you understand the not only the agreement in 95, but the reaffirmation of that agreement? Is it your belief that, as it stands right now, Jewish people who had been killed during the Holocaust, and maybe even more broadly, Jewish people are somehow off limits to Mormon baptism, Mormon proxy baptism?
Well, the problem that we have, and it is a very difficult problem, I must say, from both sides. I try to understand the feeling of the church, their doctrine, which is sometimes difficult for me to follow and to understand, but I respect it. But what I felt as a survivor very strongly is that while I understand and respect their feeling, I felt there is a lack of understanding on our part. Now, originally, 380,000 survivors, which was told to us by the then head of the Family History Department and by Senator Hatch, were posthumously baptized. Victims like my parents. Now, they all appeared in the records as having been baptized. Now, this continued over the last several years. This led to the meeting yesterday to try to come to a solution. I must say the meeting was held in a good spirit. I respect the members of the church. They are trying to understand our feelings, and I think most of them do. But the facts are there. Posthumous baptism has continued into 2004 and possibly even into 2005. This goes on. 2 billion people have been baptized by the church, not just Jews. We don't have that many. We are a small group. We are 13 million people. The Mormon church has 12 million people. We are almost the same. Now, what the point of the meeting was to try to find a solution to this problem. I respect the church. I know they try to respect us. How can we solve a problem that has bothered us for the last 10 years, ever since I became aware of it? That was the reason for the meeting, and we tried to deal with it.
I want to get David Rancher to respond a bit, but it sounds like there's a kind of a doctrinal impasse here, Ernest Michel, that they have a divine mandate to baptize on the earth everyone who's ever lived. How do you work that out?
Well, that divine, as you call it, affects me. It hurts me. I respect the church. I respect their doctrine. I think they have every right to do what they want. But if it begins to affect me and my family, then I get up and I say, you can't do that. And that led to yesterday's meeting. And let me come to the bottom line. I think it was a very good meeting. We had an understanding. We come to some conclusions. They are not permanent. They are on the table. My reaction is, and I mentioned it at the beginning when you asked me, I'm cautiously optimistic that something will come out of it.
David Rancher, let me give you a chance to respond, because I think on the sort of fundamental point of baptizing Jews, there wasn't an agreement struck in 1995 or yesterday.
As far as future baptisms?
Exactly. That remains the impasse, it sounds.
Well, what we have agreed to is that we, at this time, would not send lists of known Jews through the church's extraction program and ultimately send those directly to the temple. What we have said, that we would limit any future baptisms of Jews to descendants who have Jewish ancestry, who are members of the church, and the Jewish community, I believe, has always understood that and have agreed to that, that where there is a direct line relationship there, and that they have that right now as a member of the church to do that. So we welcomed the meeting. As Ernest has explained, I think it was a very cordial meeting. I think we were able to get a number of the key issues on the table. They have generously brought to us a list of names which they believe warrant further investigation. Some of those baptism dates do go until quite recent. We've not had a chance to investigate those to date. That is why we have agreed to set up a committee to investigate those, to try and provide for them information on why those names were cleared and at whose instance they were performed. What we have tried several times to assure them is that the church itself as a practice is not sending lists or names. We're neither gathering those off of Holocaust lists. We're not gathering those off of the Internet. We're not using known Jewish synagogue records. We're not using any of those types of lists to send out and to index those names from them.
Do you think that it's being made as clear as it can possibly be made, for example, from the pulpit? And I'm thinking of the recent General Conference. I'm not sure if that issue was addressed, but why not just make it as abundantly clear as possible, have President Hinckley or one of the members of the Quorum of the Twelve, some high-ranking official, make it as clear as you possibly can? Because it sounds like what you're saying is it's difficult to control zealous members. It's difficult to control well-meaning members. But if you make it clear in your church publications from the pulpit, wouldn't that solve a big problem? Part of the problem.
It's certainly one of the vehicles that we use. And a week ago, Elder Eyring of the Quorum of the Twelve did make that abundantly clear in his talk and in his presentation that, again, the church members' responsibility was to their own ancestors. And so, as recently, and that was brought up in the meetings yesterday, that as recently as the week prior, a member of the Quorum of the Twelve had reiterated the policy and stated very clearly what that policy was. And so that's one of the ways that we try to make that apparent. We do a number of different things that we try to make it clear to our church members. But as far as being able to actually enforce, that's a completely different issue on trying to enforce policy. We continue to try to teach the correct policies and procedures.
585 West is the number to join the conversation. We've been neglecting callers. Forgive me. Let's go to the phones. Joyce is with us in Salt Lake. Joyce, welcome to the program.
Hello. Just as background, I do have a Jewish pedigree, but I don't have any religious belief. And I've been following this debate for many years. I think just from this is a question I've long wanted to ask. Whenever I hear about Mormons baptizing the world, I sort of take it as a sweet thing that they want everyone to have some sort of gift and knowledge, but I also consider it a fiction, and it's a religious fiction, and I have never really understood why, from a Jewish point of view, if someone is Jewish, strongly Jewish, they would take anything the Mormons do as a religious ritual this seriously. If it is a fiction, this whole baptism thing, it's not going to turn anyone who's Jewish into a Mormon. And so I'm asking Carol and Ernest, why worry about a fiction?
Carol Skydell is with us and Ernest Michel. And I want to let me just sort of tack on what Joyce is saying to a number of emails which have come, among them Brad, who writes, if Mormon theology is true, Carol Skydell is denying her ancestors' essential ordinances. If it's not true, the Mormons are wasting their time, and so is she. Boyd writes that baptisms for the dead merely cleanses the sins for them. The idea is not that this person's soul in the afterlife will be able to accept the baptism or not. While I disagree with many of the church's policies, I don't think this should be an issue. So to this question of why does it matter, I think I asked it in some other form earlier, Carol Skydell or Ernest Michel, how about Carol Skydell, you first?
Yes. How does it matter?
Yeah.
It is the creation of a false record, and that's what matters, whether I believe it has validity or I think it is silly, makes no difference. It is the creation of a false record. I would like to ask one question, if I may, of Mr. Rencher, who's been quite informative to me, anyway. When names are submitted for ordinances, is that not done through something called the Temple Ready Program?
Yes, that's the current process. It's the current program that we use.
Right. And is that the only program that is used?
Currently, yes.
Okay. What is the date of that program? When was that created, or its latest amendment, or whatever you want to call it, the issue date?
We haven't made a revision to that recently because we have been working on other programs, but it was created in the late 90s, and we have been satisfied with its performance, and so it's basically, I think I would have to say that it's quickly becoming outdated software at this point.
But Carol Skydell, you're making a point here that is what? That it's flawed and names are slipping through?
My point is that seems to be the gateway by which names are submitted. If that is the gateway, does that program specifically state to the submitter what the rules are?
The answer is unequivocally yes. It does say by policy that they are not to gather lists of names, mm-hmm. and that they are to be focusing on their own ancestors.
Right.
Since this is a distributed system, this is not a headquarters-controlled mm-hmm. method by which we clear names for temple ordinances.
Mm-hmm.
The individual at that point is brought to that point and given an opportunity to say, yes, they're related, no, they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And if they choose to override that, they go against church policy in so declaring it, but that pop-up screen is there to try and, again, reiterate and give them some sense of what the policy is and to have them adhere to it.
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if that could not be somehow reinforced so that people are not told, oh, just ignore that.
Well,
I don't know.
I don't know who's telling them to just ignore it. We certainly don't preach for
them
to ignore it.
I realize that. And I realize the difficulty of conveying to such a large group of patrons the rules.
This is Ernest Michel.
Please,
I'd like
yes.
to add another dimension to the very interesting and appropriate question raised by the lady who was on the telephone. Aside from the personal hurt that I felt when I read that my father and my mother and other relatives are now posthumously baptized, there's another important dimension. I'm a Holocaust survivor. Today, there are books written all over the world, articles. The Holocaust never happened. It's a fake. It's a hoax. Written books have talked about it. People have, on talk shows, say, this is never happened. They're telling this to me, who stood in front of the gas chambers, who knew what it was, and they're saying they didn't exist. What bothers me and affects me emotionally is that in the future, 50 years, 100 years from now, if we would not do something about it now while we are still alive, then people who say, look, come, what are you talking about? Here they are baptized by the Mormon Church. That affects me. Hmm. And the fact that maybe in 15, 20 years, God willing, if I'm not here any longer, that my name might appear as among those having been baptized. So it's an emotional issue that affects every one of the Jews, although I must admit there are quite a number of Jews who agree with your feeling who said, who cares? It doesn't mean anything to me anyway. To me, and I would say to the majority of the Jewish community, it makes a big, big difference.
Let me read an email. It comes from an anonymous emailer. I have a question not specifically about the Jewish baptisms, but it's relevant. I know if the Mormons baptized deceased persons of all faiths. We have deceased relatives who may have been baptized into this faith, which they did not choose when alive. My question is this. How can we learn whether any of our relatives were so baptized, and if they were, how can we get them, as she writes, unbaptized? Is there a response, David Rencher? You mentioned there's no way to do that.
Certainly, we don't have an ordinance that unbaptizes them. I think it's an important point to make too that they are not added to the membership roles of the church. They're not considered members of the church at that point. All we're saying is that an ordinance was performed on their behalf in a temple. The IGI is available at the Family History Library. It's available at Family History Centers. Certainly, if they want to find out and go see that. Check for names on the IGI. They can do that. They can do it online at www.familysearch.org.
So. 585 West is the number, 585-9378. Back to the phones. Janice is with us in Salt Lake. Janice, welcome.
Hi. A couple of things. I was raised Mormon here in Utah, and then I spent the last half of my life in New York City. And I can tell you two things. One, they won't quit doing this. They'll simply just bury the names. They'll continue doing it, popes, Joan of Arc, Jews, and they won't broadcast those names, like they're going to take the names off. The second thing I was wondering for Mr. Rencher is, how would you feel if Joseph Smith and all the prophets and all the major leaders of the church, we can just take their names to a Catholic church and have them, you know, christened into Catholicism, and then they can be on the rolls of the Catholic Church? How would you feel about that?
David Rencher, you understand the passion.
I understand the passion. I don't know that my feelings are pertinent here, but I've had leaders of various faiths pray for me. I guess the question is, if a Jew says a prayer for me at the wall, or if a Navajo has a blessing way held on my behalf, I consider it one of something that certainly is sacred to them. My personal opinion is I'm not offended. In fact, I'm honored that they would think enough of me to include me, but I realize that not everyone shares that view, and I certainly respect the views of others. But I also know that each religion has what it considers pearls of great price within its religion, and that at times those are offered to those not of their faith. And I certainly accept the fact that at any given time, without my knowledge, anyone could be praying for me or doing something else. I guess I just a little more tolerant on that issue.
May I interject here, please?
Is this Carol Skydell?
This is Carol Skydell.
Okay, sorry. Yes,
I feel that the issue of someone saying a prayer for you in their own faith, that's fine. That's not a problem. There is no permanent record of the fact that someone said a prayer for you, and that would have no meaning. However, in the rituals performed by the church, the baptism for the dead, the confirmation of the dead, who is confirmed as a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Now, that is a record, and I find this troubling.
Well, you referred to it earlier as a fictional record, and I guess we would differ on that point. I consider it a record of something that actually happened in a particular temple on that date, and so it is a record of an ordinance that was performed. Mm-hmm. You certainly can question the validity of that or the efficacy of that ordinance. I certainly respect your right to question that, but it is an official record within the context of our religion that that event occurred in that temple on that date. Again, it did not turn them into a member of the church, and we do not claim them within the roles of our membership of the church. That does not make them a member of our church.
Would you not agree that this is somewhat of a contradiction when you say, I confirm you a member of the church, and on the other hand, you say you're not a member of the church? I think you would agree that this leads to some kind of confusion.
I don't think on the air I'm going to get into a discussion of specific wording that takes place in sacred temples. I'm not quite sure how you're privy to that information, but it is an offer that certainly is made on their behalf, and and that, I think, is the difference of opinion.
Let's try to take a few more calls. Jordan is joining us from Sugar House. Jordan, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to ask if a person left it in their will that they expressly did not want to be baptized into any other faiths or churches, would the LDS Church recognize that when considering them for later baptisms?
Jordan, thanks. We'll get a response. Jordan?
Yeah.
Did you have something else?
Oh, no.
No, okay, sorry. Thank you, sorry. David Rencher, do you have any response for that, any answer to that question? Could there be an express request that, in fact, someone not be baptized posthumously by this proxy baptism?
Certainly they can do anything they want with their will or to so stipulate. At the present, I don't know that we have a mechanism for creating a list of names of those who have willed not to have this work done. Again, given that it is a distributed computer environment, it's very difficult to manage some of these names. I did share with the Jewish community yesterday the fact that we had once again discovered that a name had slipped through the system. We immediately removed it when we discovered it, but the way it slipped through was that they created a fictitious birthplace for it. So they listed the birthplace as Canada rather than where the birth actually took place. And that, you know, people, no matter what system you establish, if there are people intent on circumventing the system, they'll generally find a way to circumvent it. We, on the management side of it, try to review the file and look for discrepancies and look for ways that we can continue to honor the original agreement.
Let me read a few emails from Julie in Springville. In the LDS Church, we believe in agency. Those who are baptized for the dead are not forced to be LDS. We believe that they're free to choose according to their knowledge and feeling. We're simply offering a choice. Tracy in Provo writes, I personally submitted tens of thousands of names of Holocaust victims for proxy LDS temple work during the early 1990s. The work was performed quietly by a group of friends who felt deep love and respect for these Jewish martyrs. The records we used were those kept by their murderers, the SS, who were demonically efficient in tallying all their deeds. We ceased the practice, however, when the church asked us to, and we have not repeated it. I wonder if there is some fear, David Rencher, about a kind of snowball effect that, again, there's a doctrinal impasse here that you come to, that you have this divine mandate, as you say, to baptize people, to baptize or at least give them a chance, make this proxy offering to people. And if you get objections from the Jewish community now, I wonder if you worry about from the Anglican community, the Protestant community, the Catholic community. Are you worried about that?
Well, I think it is a form of worship for us. Certainly, at this point, I am trying to deal from a very technical standpoint with the issues raised by our Jewish friends. I'm trying to address how some names have made it into those files and who the originator was there. I think these doctrinal issues will have to be left to the leaders of the church, and they certainly will have to speak on behalf of the doctrine. But certainly there is an order to these things right now. We have made agreements of what we would and wouldn't do, and we intend in every way to maintain a good faith effort in those commitments that we have made and to continue to honor those commitments as I believe we have through the years. And so we welcome the opportunity now to get together as friends and to sit down at the table and to get these issues on the table and to look at the facts and see if we can come up with answers as to what's transpiring and why those names are appearing.
Ernest Michel, let me give you the last word. You've talked about this joint committee set up to resolve the remaining concerns. You talked about being cautiously optimistic. What are those remaining concerns, and what do you think's next in this process?
Well, I'm glad that you give me a chance to voice that. I'm cautiously optimistic because for the first time, there was an agreement that a working committee would be set up that will meet regularly. The first meeting to take place before June 1st, between equal representation from professionals at the church and experts of genealogy in the Jewish community. They are going to deal on a regular basis with these issues, with the guidelines having been set at the meeting yesterday, which clearly states that no Holocaust victim can be in the future baptized, as well as any Jew who has been baptized as well. Therefore, in the future, this is something that has to be discussed, the details to be worked out. It is a huge problem. There is no doubt in my mind there will be glitches, that not everything will be working perfect, but there is a word that was yesterday used, that's trust. I believe that we have trust each other, that we are trying to do the right thing, and in doing so, help both ourselves in the Jewish community and satisfy the needs of the Mormon Church.
Ernest Michel is chairman of the New York-based World Gathering of Jewish Holocaust Survivors. He joined us from his office there in New York. Ernest Michel, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Carol Skydell, an amateur genealogist, was joining us from her home in California. Carol Skydell, thank you very much.
And thank you.
And David Rentscher is the director of records and information for the Family History Library of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program is directed by Mike Anderson. Our thanks to Jenny Badger. Radio West is produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.